want the Republicans to wake up is the Republican Party right now is not led by conservatives. There's a population out there that has to be told the truth. We have to do it live.
Now, from the left coast, it's another podcast edition of the Peter B. Collins Show. Peter B. is curious, opinionated, and relentless in pursuit of the truth like a honeybee drawn to pollen. He's an independent progressive, ready to sting Republicans and Democrats alike when they deserve it. After years in commercial radio, Peter B. welcomes you to this audio adventure in news and politics with no corporate filter. Listeners support this program, and you can help at peterbcollins.com. Here's your humble host, Peter B.
Welcome to a fresh edition of the Peter B. Collins Show. We are supported by listeners, and we name names. Thanks to Sherry Willoughby, Andrew Krieger, Bill Lackamacher, and Joan Falbert, voluntary subscribers to this show. Actually, this is radio everywhere. I want to thank our listeners around the country and across the globe. Listeners in Costa Rica, Japan, England, Spain. And that guy who keeps trying to contribute from Denmark but can't get PayPal to work. If you're able and you'd like to help, just go to my website, peterbcollins.com. On the right-hand side, there's a link, and our voluntary subscriptions start as low as $5 a month. And today's topic?
And now this word from our sponsor. Have you lost your appetite for politics? Not interested in big elections? Do you feel ambivalent every 4 years? You may be suffering from erectile dysfunction.
Our subject today, the recent special election in Massachusetts. Did Scott Brown really win?
Something's telling me I must go home.
Jonathan D. Simon joins us here in our secret studio, and you do have to take the Dick Cheney pledge not to disclose our location. Jonathan, welcome.
I'm not even sure where we are, but thank you very much. Glad to be here.
He is the executive director of the Election Defense Alliance and a citizen of the Commonwealth of Massachusetts. Good to have you here in California today.
Thanks, Peter.
I was drawn to a report that you published at the end of August entitled, Believe It or Not, the Massachusetts Special Election for U.S. Senate. And this is the seat that Ted Kennedy held for 30-plus years. And Massachusetts, we thought, was a pretty reliable Democratic state. Now, that's a partisan angle, but you focus on the way elections are conducted, and you've done a pretty thorough analysis with the limited available data and come up with some very interesting, what I would call information, and you can't call it fully conclusive. But you raise very serious doubts about the authenticity of the vote count and the outcome in this election. Now, before we dive into it, you have some very interesting footnotes in your report. And one, I first want to give a shout out to my friend Dave Berman in Eureka, California, because Dave was the first to persuade me to look at elections in a simple manner. Do we have confidence in the outcome? And let me ask you that question related to the special Senate race and election in Massachusetts. Is there widespread confidence in the outcome, or are you kind of a lone wolf saying, I just don't think this came out right?
Well, Peter, there is widespread confidence in the outcome because one of the things that Americans have learned to trust over generations are the numbers that would roll up behind Walter Cronkite or David Brinkley or Dan Rather telling you who's winning on election night and what the votes are. And so there's this pretty much universal assumption that whatever the machines spit out, whatever the vote totals are accurate. In this particular election, there is nothing but faith to go on that those machines are putting out numbers that reflect the intent that went into them on the part of the voters. In other words, that they're actually counting ballots as cast. And to, you know, explain that, basically, there are no exit polls done. Mm-hmm. There were no audits. There were no spot checks. There were no examinations of actual voter marked ballots. And Massachusetts is largely counted by optical scanner. These ballots were never taken out of their storage compartments. They're not permitted to be examined by the inquiring citizen.
Mm-hmm.
And so there was nothing to verify that the numbers that came out reflected the votes that went in.
And as we'll discuss in a moment, I've always had deep suspicions about this murky private company, LHS, which manages the elections in Massachusetts. But before we get to that, I want to point out one other footnote in your report, because you echo something that I have said to many people, that the 2008 elections did not reflect honest and accurate vote counting in this country. And because many of the people who've been critical of elections and who've claimed election fraud, particularly in the presidentials of 2000 and 2004, were on the left, on the Democratic side, well, because we got more or less what we wanted out of the results, a lot of people are complacent and said, well, that's not a problem anymore. But you write here that the 2008 general election was anything but a quote-unquote all clear. Explain.
Right. Well, when Obama won and was giving his victory speech in 2008 on election night, some of us were sitting around computers. We essentially put together a data gathering war room. And I, for one, never even went to view his speech on the television because we were busy downloading exit poll data and any other data we could get our hands on.
There's a great speech in Grant Park and Jesse Jackson cried.
I'm sorry I missed it. It probably was the sole high point of the last 10 years, soon to be, you know, plowed under in many, many respects from a progressive standpoint. But we were gathering data, and what that data eventually showed was that there was actually more of a red shift. And what a red shift is when vote counts wind up to the right, to the more Republican side or the more right-wing side, of the baselines that we have. And the baselines we have are pre-election polls, exit polls, hand counts. And in 2008, in fact, there was more vote shifting than there even had been in 2004, when it was enough to cost Kerry the election. In 2008, it was not sufficient to alter the outcome. Mm-hmm. And the reason for that was there was a, as far as we can tell, I mean, this is somewhat speculative, but the dynamic of that particular election was that in late September, if we can cast our memories back, the Lehman Brothers failed and mm-hmm. there was a crash, and what had been a very close contest became a blowout in favor of Obama.
And John McCain suspended his campaign for 20 minutes to return to Washington to fix the problem. I remember that.
That's right. And basically everything he did sort of boomeranged against him for many reasons. But the bottom line was that the polls began to show a much wider gap. And as far as we understand the mechanisms, election rigging is not yet so technically sophisticated that you can just wave a magic wand on election night, you know, from some aerial flyover and all of a sudden change the machines. The way it works is there's a deployment in the months preceding the election mm-hmm. of memory cards and code programming into these machines that has to be calibrated to quite carefully mm-hmm. to produce the result that the rigger would want to see, but not rig so much that it increases the risk of detection.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a fine line there, and the calibration in 2008 would have been relative to the standing of the candidates when these mechanisms were deployed. So that might have been in August or September, but certainly not in the month of October. It was too late to go around and change all this.
Mm-hmm.
So in a sense, our best understanding of that situation is that the rig was overwhelmed and essentially superseded by these 11th hour developments. And there was a precedent for that because essentially the same thing happened in the off-year election of 2006. And we wrote a paper about that called Landslide Denied. And basically what happened in 2006 was that, again, to just about the same time, the 11th hour, end of September, there was the Foley scandal and the Haggard scandal and the Swaggart scandal and the book that Woodward wrote, mm-hmm. State of Denial on Iraq, right. And just a complete cascade of bad news out of Iraq, as a consequence of which the Republicans across the nation went into free fall during the month of October. And that was reflected. There's a thing called the Cook Political Survey and the mm-hmm. generic congressional ballot. Are you going to vote for a Democrat? Are you going to vote for a Republican come Election Day? The Democrats had a 9% lead in the first week of October among likely voters. And by the last week of October, that lead was 26%, which was a free fall that's virtually unprecedented in that pre-election, 11th hour period. And it did exactly the same thing in 2006, where the Democrats seemed to pick up all these seats. And yet we found that there were in the House elections across the country on the aggregate, there were 3 million votes net that were lost to the Democrats and gained by the Republicans as a result of what appears to be manipulation of the computers.
Mm-hmm. Well, and in 08, I reduce it to a simpler phrase. Obama was able to rack up a margin that overcame the margin of graft.
Essentially correct. Yeah.
That, and he brought in a few states that had not gone Democratic. I think there were, 10 or 11 in the last three or four cycles. And so he was able to rack up those Electoral College votes that put him over the top. But coming back to the central point, do you have confidence that we had a free and fair, accurate election in 2008?
No, absolutely not.
Yeah.
And the data shows that we did not.
Mm-hmm. So before we dive into the numbers in Massachusetts and the comparison that you did, tell us a little bit about LHS Corporation, because, those of us in the West, we still do it the old-fashioned way where our bankrupt state government manages the elections. And while we do use electronic voting machines, our Secretary of State, Deborah Bowen, has made significant gains where we only have touchscreen machines, one per precinct for disabled voters, and that, we've tried to reduce the level of control that private corporations have. Not to say that we're free and clear here in California, but we don't have an LHS vendor in between the state agency and the registrars of voters.
Well, before you get too self-congratulatory about California, I mean, you have, within the government itself, some rather suspect administrators who I prefer not to name. I'm an out-of-stater after all, but
I won't be offended.
Dean Logan comes to mind,
sure.
As one. So whether it's privatized or not, that California is certainly not out of the danger zone.
And let's just be clear what you're talking about. Logan is one of those people who worked in the industry and is now a public official managing elections in an important jurisdiction.
Right. There's something of a revolving door in this, as mm-hmm. As there are in many aspects of government. But California, I mean, there have been studies done. Some very detailed and exhaustive studies done around Prop 8, for instance, that showed mm-hmm. that vote appears to have been manipulated, or at least there are anomalies there that defy benign explanation. Again, our resources are, we're fighting this war with pop guns and suction cup arrows. Our resources are very, very limited. And we'll get into it, I hope, later. But, I mean, the information that is made publicly available is shrinking mm-hmm. in almost direct proportion to how much trouble we make with the information we get.
Right.
It's becoming more difficult to do election forensics, which is what our specialty gig is.
Mm-hmm.
But in Massachusetts, you know, you asked for a little information about LHS, and that is the operative word. I mean, a little information will have to do because they are quite secretive and quite behind the corporate veil. They handle the actual programming and deployment of the machines throughout New England. There are a couple of states that are mixed, Massachusetts actually being one of them, but they handle the majority of the deployment, servicing, maintenance, programming for Massachusetts. I think for all of it for New Hampshire and certain other states.
Mm-hmm.
So their reach is quite large. It's entirely privatized. And they're secretive to the point of, you know, you can get virtually no information from their website. It's not like they have a public relations spokesman or spokesperson. And, you know, they've been found doing some very odd things with ballots and with machines and all that. That's not my specialty. Other people have, you know, tried to, you know, track that down. But suffice it to say that their LHS track record is not a clean one. And that goes both in terms of the record of some of the people who are on their top staff and in terms of some of the behaviors that have been observed. It remains to be, you know, it begs the question, if you have that kind of power over such a high-stakes game as an election, whether you have partisan inclinations or not, you certainly are in a position to service those who do have partisan inclinations, mm-hmm. Who actually would have a direct stake in the outcome.
Yeah.
I.e., it becomes quite easy to buy an election wholesale. Back in the old days when ballots were counted, you know, observably for the most part, it was a lot tougher. You had to buy it retail, vote by vote, mm-hmm. ballot box stuffing, Tammany Hall comes to mind, Chicago. It's not that there weren't attempts to cheat in elections. It's just that it's become infinitely easier and more covert.
And Clint Curtis, who is a real hero, by the way, is running for Congress here in California now. And just in full disclosure, I've been working a little bit with him to help him on the campaign. And he exposed that in Florida, he was working for a software company. And a guy who he later ran against for his congressional seat came in and said, I need some software that'll help us flip elections. And so to imagine that has happened in the Northeast as well, not so far-fetched. Now, how long has LHS had this relatively ironclad grip on election processes in the Northeast?
You know, I'm not an electoral historian, so yeah. I can't answer that in a definitive
but
way.
But it wasn't Mitt Romney, for example, who cut the contract with LHS. It was preceded his governorship?
Can't answer that. I can't answer that either accurately, and it's probably something that I should research. There's only, you know, so many hours in a day,
mm-hmm.
And we're kept pretty busy with the straight forensics. And again, there are other people. I mean, I think Nancy Toby in New Hampshire is somebody who would probably have an answer for that
mm-hmm.
Question. What I can say is that the advent and proliferation of vote counting computers, op scans and DREs, came about relatively recently. And really, they started moving in force in the 2002 election and have been increasing in, I guess, vote share ever since. And now they're almost have essentially a monopoly on vote counting
mm-hmm.
In the country. And ironically, I mean, they came in on the heels of HAVA, the Help America Vote Act, which was, you know, inspired by the hanging chads and the debacle in Florida in 2000. But I mean, you know, if you're anybody had been looking for a red flag at the time, the Republicans sold HAVA. HAVA was a truly bipartisan initiative. So you had people in Congress like John Conyers who genuinely wanted to see voters empowered.
Mm-hmm.
And then you had people like Mitch McConnell who got on board and really ran with HAVA. it's so wonderful when you see, you know, bipartisanship and the parties getting together. But you have to realize that Republicans spent pretty much the entire 20th century trying to make it more difficult to vote and trying to decrease voter participation. And all of a sudden you have them, you know, hawking a bill with great enthusiasm on the grounds that it would somehow, you know, make it easier to vote and increase voter participation. Mm-hmm. So when you saw that, you know, that it was not possible for the Democrats at the time to smell a rat, really, you know, it boggles the mind.
Mm-hmm.
On the other hand, virtually all Democratic Party behavior in the computerized voting era has been a mystery.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, but that was one of the first signs that something was really wrong with this picture. And you have the Republicans, you know, going completely against form and pretending that electoral participation was their, you know, their new, you know, goal in life. And,
mm-hmm.
and that was obviously completely cynical.
Mm-hmm.
So with Hava came, you know, the carrot and the stick to get rid of whatever vote counting system you had and rapidly replace it with these DREs and op scans. And so as this industry, you know, essentially exploded onto the scene, companies like LHS had a major opportunity to participate, but also companies such as Diebold, Premier, became Premier,
mm-hmm.
ESNS, which were the manufacturers of these machines and of a good deal of the programming and software that would go into them.
And service contracts. Lucrative,
lucrative service contracts, although, frankly, there isn't a whole lot of honest money to be made in voting machines, and that is illustrated by the fact that these companies traditionally were you know money losers for their mm-hmm. parent corporations and Diebold Election Division, and Diebold was actually sold in the past year in 2009 to ESNS for a grand total of $5 million,
right.
Which is about the cost of a contract, you know, for a large county, one
mm-hmm.
large county.
Mm-hmm.
So it was not money they were after. And if you know, do a little research into the pedigree of the poobahs that controlled these corporations, and I'm thinking specifically of Bob and Todd Yurosevich, the Yurosevich brothers. I mean, their pedigree was with Amundsen. Their pedigree was with radical right-wing causes.
Right.
And they plowed their fortune into voting machines.
Mm-hmm.
And to me, you know, that's the kind of coincidence that just sort of lights up when you're looking for, all right, what is the inner game here? What's the inner game of tennis
mm-hmm.
going on? They put all this money into taking control of the two leading voting machine vendors. And from there, all we see is one election after another with red shifts of competitive races. We actually see targeting of competitive races. So we did another study on that called Fingerprints of Election Theft. All this can be dug up on electiondefensealliance.org. These papers are posted there. And they basically showed, the fingerprints showed that, and again, this looked at the 2006 election, that the more competitive an election was, the more likely it was to exhibit a red shift. And, you know, to a very high degree of statistical significance, we did a paired t-test, we did linear regression. No matter how we looked at it, the more competitive a race was, the more likely you were to get a red shift. And we did that in a fairly ingenious way that I can't go into in great detail, but we basically used our own employed Survey USA as a polling firm. We had the same set of respondents being polled about competitive and non-competitive races in their jurisdictions. So we had comparisons that, because they were using the same set of polling respondents, eliminated the possibility of polling bias as a factor. So it was a clever little study, and it showed targeting. And targeting is pathognomonic of rigging, because if there's a targeting pattern, it's showing that races are being selected. It's not something it's not noise floating around in the system. It's not glitches. It's very specifically outcome attempts to be outcome determinative in races that are close enough to be able to be rigged and pass the smell test.
Right.
I mean, if you have to rig 40% of the vote, you're not going to pass the smell test. Somebody is going to stand up and say, that's ridiculous. That can't happen. Then you'd have an investigation. Then everything would be exposed. So you have to have races that are within, essentially rigging range and pass the smell test. There's another factor there, and that's, what are your baselines? What are your pre-election polls saying? And that's something we can get into.
That's where I was going to go next, because the sophistication on the front end of elections now in their ability to target people house by house and the mapping that they have developed so that they're able to use mapping, gerrymandering, and sophisticated opinion research to identify the people who they need to deal with, either to neutralize or to motivate to get out to the polls. And then when you overlay that with control or at least influence over manipulation of the tabulation of the votes that are actually cast, you see a very impressive end-to-end shift in control of our elections from the people to those who run the elections. And it's election fraud, not voter fraud, which is what we're often told is the problem.
Well, I have to say that EDA, as a relatively small organization, I mean, our bandwidth is fairly narrow, and we accept that there's a great deal wrong and undemocratic about the election system as a whole. I mean, Citizens United as a court decision, sort of empowering the corporations to weigh in with whatever happens to be in the Treasury. I mean, they're clearly distortions of what should be a democratic or, a process that respects election integrity as a whole. We tend to focus, I mean, we accept that there's gerrymandering. Somebody else will take care of that. We accept that there's attempts to bring lower voter registration and participation. These are ghastly techniques and suppression, vote suppression.
Yeah.
And we're aware that there are other organizations that focus on that and target that. What there haven't been is any organization, ACLU, NAACP, League of Women Voters, I mean, all the organizations that you would think would be all over this, or investigators that you think would be all over this, to look at what actually happens inside the machine. So that has been increasingly our focus. What we want is we want transparent, observable elections. I mean, that is the goal. That is as nonpartisan a goal as you can get. And we want to see that ideally through hand-counted paper. What that entails is actually, at least for the federal races. And if you think about, what that entails, it's actually not that much. There's a maximum of 3 federal races on any ballot. So it's eminently doable. Things can be eminently doable and still infinitely far away in terms of political reality. And that's a frustrating reality that we face, every day when we look at this. But we look at, primarily what's happening inside the machines, which is part of that spectrum of dishonesty or manipulative attempts. And, as bad as gerrymandering is, it's happening essentially observably out in the open. May happen behind closed committee doors or whatever, but it's something that the public can observe.
It's a known known.
And get pissed about, When something is happening completely unobservably in bits and bytes in cyberspace someplace, and all you're being fed as a result in which you have no basis to have confidence other than essentially pure, unadulterated blind faith, that's what we're trying to, point out, highlight, put exclamation points in front of, generate an awareness that this is a coup, in effect, that is far more effective and dangerous than, let's say, if you went and rolled tanks down Pennsylvania Avenue, because it's unobservable and people don't believe it's happening, so it doesn't generate any resistance.
Yeah.
And so it can continue to go on as long as they, have the good sense not to bite off more than they should chew. And it's devastating in its impact. And frankly, I mean, our goal, transparent, observable vote counting, is a nonpartisan goal. But there's nothing nonpartisan about the pattern that we've observed, and right. that is that all the shifts go in one direction, and it happens to be the direction that parallels the pedigree of the ownership of these companies that control our elections.
Mm-hmm.
PDQ.
Jonathan, give us an overview of what you did in a forensic look at the special election in Massachusetts last January, where Martha Coakley was defeated by Scott Brown, according to the official results.
Well, as I said before, we didn't have exit polls to go on. What we did have was Massachusetts still has 71 communities in which voting is counted. The votes are counted by hand on hand-marked ballots, and the citizens sit there after the polls close and basically count them up, and it's observable. So if you're a Republican observer, let's say it's a Democratic-leaning community, and Massachusetts does this by town, by community. Some places do it by county or precinct, but Massachusetts does the counting in the town hall or some equivalent. So if it's a very Democratic place, a Republican is free to go in there and look and watch the counting, and vice versa. If it's a Republican place, Democrats can come in, independents can come in. So it's observable, and it's quite difficult to pull any stunts. These vote counts are the gold standard. And we looked at those, and we looked at the remaining 270 or so communities where votes were counted via OpScan, optical scanning machine, where the voter marks the ballot, and then it goes through the OpScan. The OpScan reads, tabulates, drops the ballot into a box from which it never emerges. And what we found was that where votes were counted by hand, Coakley won. She won by 2.8%. And where votes were counted by optical scanner, Scott Brown won. He won by 5.2%. So you had this rather enormous, from a numerical or statistical standpoint, disparity between the optical scan jurisdictions. We called it OpScan Shire, and the hand count jurisdictions. We called them Hand Countville. We basically aggregated them all together as if it was one jurisdiction. And we looked and we said, well, you know, what could explain this? And one obvious explanation, for instance, could have been, well, the OpScan scan towns were more Democratic. You know, they had more Democratic voters. Well, that wasn't the case. They were 10% more Republican. Party registration is a limited indicator in Massachusetts because about half the voting population is unenrolled or independent of the parties. So that alone, even though the hand count towns where Coakley won were more Republican, we really couldn't state anything definitive on that basis. It's a little bit probative about the nature of these constituencies, but it wasn't enough. So we went and drilled a little deeper, and we looked at the previous two Senate races, which are Kerry and Kennedy. And what we found was that the hand count jurisdictions, Hand Countville and OpScan jurisdictions, were absolutely congruent.
Yeah.
When you looked at those two Senate races, they behaved exactly the same way. When you won in one Senate race, it was a less than a 1% difference between them in one direction. The other Senate race was less than 1% difference in the other direction. When you put them both together, it was basically 0% difference. They behaved, those constituencies, exactly the same. So we looked at that and said, well, that tells you a great deal about the nature of these constituencies and who they, who, you know, what biases, what political biases they may have. And they tend to behave pretty much identically.
And you also have the history because Martha Coakley ran statewide for attorney general in 2006.
Right. And the reason we use that race is we thought, okay, you know, there is a geographical heterogeneity to these jurisdictions, and the hand count towns, if you look on the map, you know, tend to be more concentrated in rural Massachusetts. They're the smaller towns. And they, therefore, you know, because Coakley, the last 30 years, she was in eastern Massachusetts. She was Middlesex DA, and she was around the Boston area. But she came originally from Pittsfield, which is in western rural tier of Massachusetts. She went to Williams College, and we thought, well, you know, maybe there's a favorite daughter phenomenon going here, and maybe the hand count towns, you know, really like Martha Coakley because she, even though it was 30 years ago, was one of theirs. And so we looked at her only other statewide race in 2006, and we compared the hand count towns and the opscan towns, and no, there was no favorite daughter or anything. As a matter of fact, she did better in the opscan. She did about 1% better throughout the state in the opscan towns. So there was really nothing to distinguishing about these constituencies that would say, okay, that explains why Martha Coakley would win the hand count towns and lose the opscan towns in this election. There's really no explanation. Other than what was really left standing was something's happening to those votes inside those opscans. Now, one of the things we say in the paper is, have we proven that there was election fraud? No. I mean, to prove that, what we would really need is access to memory cards, code, hardware, software, ballots, actual ballots, and all that is off limits to the inquiring public. So proof is that that standard of proof or that burden of proof, if that's what's being required, then it's effectively impossible because the evidence is effectively withheld. But what we do know is the converse side is that we have all this evidence that is quite probative that shows this disparity, which is really not explicable in terms of legitimate factors. On the other hand, there's no evidence whatsoever other than the counts produced by the machines that those counts are valid.
Yeah.
As I said earlier, there's no exit polls, there's no audits, there's no spot checks, there's no examination of ballots, there's no examination of code. So on the side that should actually have the burden of proof to say this election is legitimate, they have no evidence and have met no burden of proof whatsoever. So at least, you know, in a court of law, what this would translate to is the counters of this election are given what amounts to an irrebuttable presumption of innocence.
Yeah.
That no matter what you bring against them, you can't prevail unless you find what they call these smoking guns, and that's precisely the evidence that's privatized and withheld.
Right. And if we take for a moment a presumption that there was manipulation, a recount wouldn't do any good, because the machines would produce the same count that they produced under the code the first time, right?
Nope, that's actually not true. It depends on how the recount was done. I mean, that would be the case in the most recent election that we just saw this Tuesday in Delaware, where they're using paperless DREs. And again, where the disparity between the hand counts or the absentee ballots that were hand counted and the at-the-poll ballots that were rung up on these touch screens in the Republican primary was quite extraordinary.
Well, and let's put a number on that, because my friend Brad at bradblog.com has covered this, and he's very reliable in analyzing these things. And he shows that the verifiable paper ballot absentee results, Congressman Castle handily won 54.7 to 45.3%, so a 10-point margin. But as Brad describes it, the unverifiable Election Day e-voting machine results gave O'Donnell about a 7-point victory there. And, of course, we had very low turnout, and that, of course, shifts things as well. But just on this narrow comparison between what could be verified and what couldn't, there was a significant gap. And you are much more expert on numbers than I am. I hit the wall at algebra 2. But explain just how remote the possibility is of that kind of disparity, John.
Well, we love to run numbers and figure things like this out, and this one's a relatively easy one. That disparity, the likelihood of that occurring at random is about 1 in 100 million. But lest that sound grandiose, I mean, the obvious rebuttal argument on something like absentee voting versus at poll voting is that different phenomena were at work. For instance, in Delaware, the idea that the Tea Party mobilized these voters at the last minute that these voters came out in with great enthusiasm to the polls, but that wasn't reflected in the absentee vote. These are all, it is a possibility. I mean, it is a plausible explanation, although when we see enough of these Delaware situations, we saw something even much, much more inexplicable happen in the South Carolina primary, Vic Rawl versus Alvin Green,
right.
Where somebody who had not run a campaign at all, had been completely invisible, didn't even mm-hmm. have a website,
right.
Wound up with 59% of the vote. Again, on paperless DREs, no possibility of doing any form of verification other than running the machines again and coming up with exactly the same result. I mean, that was a situation where there was no explanation having to do with Tea Partiers or political divergence or difference. This was a Democratic primary in which it would be very convenient for the Republican nominee, presumptive, the incumbent Jim DeMint, the senator, mm-hmm. to face self-destructing token meaningless opposition from the standpoint of the right wing. You can then take $3 or $4 million that you would have had to invest in the South Carolina Senate race and put it, let's say, into California to bring down Boxer or
right.
or Bowen. So you know, there were many tactical reasons for rigging that primary, but there was certainly no phenomenon to explain why something like that would happen, and it was very egregious. These are situations where, you know, if enough of these accumulate, and we've seen plenty of them over the years, it's very different from an isolated situation. You now have a pattern. They all go in the same direction. There's only so far you can go in making up ad hoc individual alibis for each individual situation when they mm-hmm. all form an overall pattern. But to get back to Massachusetts would have been susceptible to a recount because these ballots actually exist. The hand-counted ballots were sitting around in the bottom of these optical scan machines and their storage mm-hmm. bins. The problem is, first of all, that the will to do a recount has to be there in the first place. Perhaps if the election had been, you know, decided by, I don't know, 0.5% rather than 4%, mm-hmm. There would have been a recount. But if you're looking at it from a rigging standpoint, you certainly do not want to rig an election within the mandatory recount or even the optional recount range. You're going to make sure that you shift enough votes that a recount doesn't seem to be called for. And we've seen that happen, in quite a few situations as well. And the other problem with the recount is that by the time you get around to a recount, I mean, chain of custody of these ballots
sure.
Is a very delicate matter, and it's generally observed in the breach. These ballots wind up in some unlocked storeroom someplace. We strongly suspect that in Minnesota, where Al Franken eventually prevailed by just mm-hmm. a few votes, I mean, the exit polls in Minnesota had him winning that election by 10%.
Yeah.
And when a recount actually happened, and this was the Franken-Coleman Senate mm-hmm. race, the way I imagine it was the black ops team was called into action, because if, God forbid, that recount had happened and shown that the election was off by 10%, or, you know, 300,000-400,000 votes, it would have blown the entire cover on the entire capacity to manipulate elections. I mean, it would have blown the whole thing wide open. So it became what I imagine was a very, very high priority target to go in and, in all likelihood, swap out ballots by the tens of thousands with ballots that were pre-marked to fit the machine count. And in that process, you wouldn't have wanted, from the right-wing standpoint, to take that race away from Franken, because then there would have been more of a stink about it. He would have challenged it, and again, you'd have deeper investigation. Same thing happened when George Allen lost by 0.5% in the Senate race in Virginia. That was a critical Senate race at the time. It conferred the Senate majority to the Democrats. So it was about as high stakes election as the Brown-Coakley. And yet, George Allen, who officially speaking had lost by 0.5% and was within his rights to demand a recount in Virginia, he gave a bizarre press conference in which he looked for all the world like somebody who had a gun pointed at his head, you know, from behind the curtain someplace. And he basically said, I choose not to ask for a recount. I concede.
Yeah.
Almost impossible to believe that the same, you know, Karl Rove led and, you know, Republican party that would scratch and claw for every inch of territory was now giving up control of the Senate by 0.5% in Virginia. The obvious conclusion to be drawn there was that a recount would have been profoundly revealing mm-hmm. and dangerous. So they just demurred and said, yeah. Thanks, but no thanks.
Mr. Macaco, we don't need you anymore.
Exactly. And off he went. You know.
Now, John, what's been the reaction in Massachusetts? You published this report at the end of August. Was it front page news on the Boston Globe?
Oh, yes, yes. They covered it in a six-page spread, and it was all over the networks. I glibly answered that. No, of course. I mean, the mainstream media is locked down as far as this goes. Have been
Did the Phoenix,
all the way
your
around.
Alt paper, run it?
No, I think it was... I think it got picked up by something called The Examiner online, one or two articles, and we're appreciative of that. Part of that is our fault. We're good at doing the
just
analysis.
By the way, the Examiner newspaper chain is owned by the right wing billionaire Phil Anschutz from Denver.
It might have been a different Examiner.
Oh,
I don't
okay.
know. And maybe right. maybe they have overlapping, and they'll have a trademark war or something. I don't know. You know, frankly, There's a lot of angles to look at, and I don't know mm-hmm. exactly who was what the masthead of that. But it was certainly a sympathetic column
okay.
that was written, and it's been picked up. I mean, we've gotten a couple of thousand hits, and but frankly, so some of it's our fault. We don't have much of a PR apparatus.
But even if you could afford Hill and Knowlton. The PR firm yeah. to corporate goons, would it show up? I mean, Rachel Maddow, you would think, would want to even mention this, or Keith Olbermann as a sidebar. And I give them credit for the stories they cover, but MSNBC pulls a lot of punches, and there are a lot of stories that never see a moment on that network.
Well, this is about as untouchable as it gets. I suppose, you could throw in the Kennedy assassination and you could throw in 9/11 mm-hmm. and what really happened and all that. But this is about as untouchable. And, I guess I try to look at it. I think one of my strengths has been being able to see things through the eyes of others. And I really try to look at it from the standpoint of those who have a stake in America as the beacon of democracy. And this is something that is inculcated in us from nursery school on. I mean, there we were doing the Pledge of Allegiance and learning about George Washington and whatnot. And it's pretty strong. And in this case, I think there is this terrible fear. And it's like, when you go to a therapist, it's always the things that you're most afraid of revealing that after 5 years of therapy, finally come out. And you begin with all these cover stories, And I think this is similar in the sense that the wall of denial is tremendously high. I mean, it could never happen here. This is America. And if we did reveal this, one of two things would happen. We'd be ridiculed and marginalized. Or, this is from the standpoint of Keith Olbermann or Rachel Maddow or whoever it might be, John Stewart. Or if it did get legs and it did get traction, it would bring down this country and this system because we couldn't stand the shock to our sort of national, pious national identity that we do things right here. This is not a third world country. Our elections are above reproach, et cetera, et cetera. So whereas a lot of the people, for instance, in the wake of the 2004 election, Zogby ran a poll, and I think it was like 45% of the people did not believe the results of that election, certainly in Ohio, but even nationwide. The higher up you go in the hierarchy, in the power structure, people who have arisen to their position by virtue of the system as it operates, as it is, the more reluctant they are to rock the boat. In addition to which, there may be frank intimidation going on. I mean, we don't know. There's inner games all over in politics.
Well, but,
John, that may be
a
part of it.
I hear what you're saying, but I think you're being too generous, because I feel that if, you know, we're really on the cusp here of falling into a corporatocracy, and you reference the Citizens United decision that allows corporations to directly buy campaign ads in candidate elections. They used to have restrictions on that. They had to go through political action committees. And so this is a creeping problem, and I believe that we can't be so generous to those who say, well, the system worked for me. Nancy Pelosi gets reelected every time with 84%, 86% of the vote. So she doesn't have to worry about this. But it really is fundamental to our democracy. John, my concern is that we really are seeing this spin out of control, and that like the, you know, the boiling lobster or the boiling frog, that we will be cooked before we really respond to this and try to correct it. And so I do appreciate you getting into the shoes and the mindset of those who are unwilling to do anything about this. But the whole Tea Party phenomenon, to me, is generated by the media and endorsed by the media, when in fact it's a corporate move through Sal Russo and the Tea Party Express, through David Koch and Americans for Prosperity, and Dick Armey's Freedom Works. These are people who are creating a phony movement, and it's starting to gain traction. And, you know, if we couple that with elections that are manipulated and fraudulently run, then we've really, we're just actors. We're just extras in a movie that we don't have any script rights over.
I could not put it better myself. I mean, I absolutely gnash my teeth on an hourly basis over exactly what you've just said. If this game were not rigged, I do not believe that we'd be in the situation we are. And part of the reasoning behind that is that when you rig an election, especially critical elections like Coakley Brown, that election was a sign. It was a, you know, burning cross. That you not only seat certain individuals in office, but you construct a national portrait that for the succeeding year, 2 years, could be 5 years, becomes the snapshot that we all carry in our wallets of what America is.
Mm-hmm.
And this succession of shifted elections, even though Obama won, even though the Democrats won in 2006, their victories were significantly mitigated and undercut over what the actual will of the public was. And now, of course, we have this, you know, backflow that seems to be gathering momentum again through, in all likelihood, manipulated elections. That combination, as you say, is absolutely deadly. Mm-hmm. And it enables, you know, the portrait of America to become a conservative country, a right-wing country. And you have all these people out there who are apparently acting against interest, against their own economic interest, and they're often against their own social interest.
Yeah.
And you scratch your head and you say, what the hell is going on? You know, what is this all about? And as you say, I mean, the media has a big role in it, and the rigged elections seem to have a big role in it. And, you know, we don't know what precisely what element is responsible for this. I mean, it certainly isn't a left-wing element being masochistic. Somewhere on the right.
Well, and there are plenty of angry people on the left who don't have access to the media. The Tea Party brings 10 people together, and Glenn Beck and others, you know, start this, and it's echoed throughout. And this phony sense that all Americans are angry is a narrative and a meme that is sustained by the media.
Yes.
And you also have criticism of the media because they're now, you referenced it a little bit earlier, John, but they have stopped broadcasting or publishing the exit polls that they continue to conduct. And they use them to project results so that they can, wrap things up before midnight so they don't have to keep Chris Matthews up late and go into overtime. But I don't care about getting a snapshot result on election night. I want to get it right. And we learned in 2000 that the republic does not crumble when we don't have a result the day of the election or even the day after.
Right. Again, this is not a desire that has bubbled up through, you know, the will of the people to have immediate election results. This is something that's been sold to us, by the Walmart of mass media. By the way, they're not just withholding a court. Looking at the most recent primaries, the last several primaries, the networks are not just withholding exit poll results. They're withholding vote returns as well. So in their view, in the view of the powers that be, we are the troublemakers. I mean, the people who actually look at these figures and say, wait a minute, there's something wrong with this picture. Here's a forensic analysis. You know, this is what the exit polls say. We're troublemakers. And to the extent that we have made too much trouble and caused them, you know, either embarrassment or, you know, potentially worse, we need to be blinded. And what's happening is we're being blinded. They're taking away the information that has been traditionally public information. What we can't call out, what we can't see, what's invisible to us. So what we're basically being told now is so-and-so won, X won. And then if they deign to tell us why, based again on these exit polls, which are still being run, they'll tell us that they won because there was this outpouring of anger or there was this late breaking vote or whatever it is. We have no basis for knowledge that that is the explanation or that, in fact, that candidate actually won. We're just being told who won. We're not even being given numbers. And this is a tremendously far cry from when I was growing up. You know, you sat down on election night, you waited, you sweated out through the night, the numbers rolled up behind Walter Cronkite, and it sort of dates me a bit, but, you know, or Dan Rather or Tom Brokaw or Peter Jennings or whoever it was. Mm-hmm. And we learned to trust those numbers. Now, perhaps we shouldn't have trusted those numbers then either, and there are those who say that elections, even back then, were subject to a great deal of manipulation. The thing is, now it's wholesale manipulation. It's easy as pie. Anybody with a, you know, high school level understanding of computers and programming can do it. This, by the way, is not, you know, a figment of our imagination. This has been verified by the Brennan Center at NYU, mm-hmm. by Johns Hopkins, by Princeton, by MIT, you know, by the Government Accountability Office, mm-hmm. University of Pennsylvania, Steve Freeman.
Right.
I mean, from an academic standpoint, the vulnerability of our election system in and of itself, even if we had no evidence that that vulnerability was resulting in actual manipulation, the vulnerability itself makes it insane, collective insanity, to trust the system. But when you then couple it with the ownership of the machines, and you couple it with the evidence that we keep getting that unidirectional shifting of votes relative to any baseline we can find. And of course, as we're just discussing, they're taking those baselines away, taking the exit polls away. I can discuss what's happening with the pre-election polls as well. But to date, you know, we've had several elections during this era, during computerized voting era, where we have had baselines, and you couple that with the ownership of the machines, and you couple that with the vulnerability of the machines, and you know, how hard is it to connect three dots? This is not a complex, you know, thriller like The Bourne Identity.
Mm-hmm.
This is pretty straightforward, simple stuff. And yet, that's why I say the wall of denial is so high. It could never happen here. I don't want to hear it. Takes place on so many levels and probably nowhere more devastatingly than among those who you would think would make it their first priority in their job to bring the truth to light. And you mentioned Rachel Maddow, you mentioned Keith Olbermann. I mean, in the aftermath of the 2004 election, Keith Olbermann was all over this issue. In the weeks after that election, he had people on. He had Harvey Wasserman on. I think he had these various different people on. I may have the names wrong, but he had people on who were doing Steve Freeman.
Yep.
He cited the papers, looked at this stuff, was all over it. It was, in short, by far the biggest story of his lifetime in sports or in news. And all of a sudden, he was on vacation for 2 weeks, and he swore up and down that it was a plan, it had always been planned, and blah, blah, blah. And when he came back from that vacation, omerta, silence, not a word about this ever again in that context of 2004. And I mean, even if you had a planned vacation, we've all had planned vacations, something like this comes up, if you're not being just basically told off, then you cover it. And Keith Olbermann's not the only one. There are other who in his case, it was very public. There are others who I've had private conversation with who I would prefer not to name, but leading journalistic exponents and people who are willing to dig deep, who have said, look, we just can't cover this. Our outfit organization will not allow us to touch this. We hear that and we just say, well, you know, Alice in Wonderland, is everybody here crazy? I mean, why, damn it, is there all this support for this fraud? And frankly, we don't have an answer. I mean, when we present this to people, one of the first things we hear back is, well, if there was anything there, wouldn't the Democrats be all over it? And we say, all right, you know, we don't know. It's possible ignorance. It's possible stupidity. It's possible naivety. It's possible complicity. We don't know the explanation. But the fact is, no, they're not. They'll block this at every turn. It leaves us, well, you know, Cassandra from the Greek mythology, you know, who saw the facts, who knew there were, in one famous instance, you know, Greeks inside the Trojan horse, who nobody believed. And I've long felt that that was the cruelest of the punishments of the gods. It was crueler than being hung up on a cliff to have your liver eaten out. Because to know something to be the case and to know that it's going to be devastating, to know that it's going to result in slaughter and death and whatnot, and to be not believed is a very, very, very cruel phenomenon. And I mean, we've been facing that for years, you know, in our own way. And I mean, I know personally for myself, I'm not a particularly obsessive person. So, you know, I basically keep my life balanced and I'd sort of keep this compartmentalized. But it's a very, very dark component and compartment of my mind and of my life. It's something that I would give a great deal to be able to walk away from. I can't think of anything we get out of this other than, you know, in many cases, ruined marriages, failing businesses, complete exhaustion, nervous breakdowns. You know, the people I know, the colleagues I know, have not fared well doing this, and we basically make nothing in terms of remuneration.
Sure.
The doggedness comes from the fact that, you know, it's the Kitty Genovese phenomenon. You know, if you're watching democracy get stabbed to death, you know, outside your window, can you just, you know, pull the shade and go back to watching, you know, American Idol? I mean,
on American Idol, you can't trust the voting.
There
are more people concerned about that than our elections of public officials, unfortunately.
Absolutely. When you look at some of the things that get play and you look at some of the things that rise to the top level, you know, of news coverage and of, oh my God, how can that happen? And then you look at this and you look at the, you know, the comparison in terms of what it means to people's freedoms, to their well-being, to their just to their nation as a whole. I mean, I don't know how else to put it. You know, and then you see what the news actually does go out and cover. I mean, one other angle here, and you know, we've covered this in an op-ed which I could not get published in the Progressive Populist. And if you know the Progressive Populist, I mean, it's the merger of progressivism and populism, and it's got some of the wonderful, you know, progressive authors. Molly Ivins used to be there before her death, and it is dedicated to exactly this, you know, to this type of, on the part of the people, you know, taking self-empowerment. And I wrote an op-ed that they would not publish. And that was the point at which I said, wait a minute, maybe I need to take a long sabbatical, some time off, because, I mean, if I can understand not getting it into the Times. If I can't get it into the Progressive Populist, there's something very, very wrong with this picture.
Yeah.
And the op-ed was basically, look, you know, you've got A-Rod, you know, Alex Rodriguez, you got Roger Clemens, you got Lance Armstrong, you got, you know, Barry Bonds, you got all these characters in virtually every major sport, the Olympics and NASCAR and everything. And when nobody's looking, they're all cheating, you know, up the wazoo to get, you know, more home runs or more strikeouts or faster times or whatever it is. And then you got Bernie Madoff and you got Goldman Sachs and Enron.
Let me just pick one of those. To have Roger Clemens being pursued for lying to Congress over whether or not he used steroids, and to see Tom Feeney get elected to Congress, and then when Clint Curtis went and forensically proved that he beat Feeney, and the Democratic-controlled House Administration Committee said, never mind, Clint, that shows us where the priorities are.
Yeah, only in Wonderland. I mean, this is truly Alice in Wonderland. And, you know, I don't know what to say, but, you know, you look at all these situations and you look at what's going on in all these high-stakes games, and then you take the highest-stakes game of all. You got a $12 trillion economy. When last I checked, it's probably more by now. You've got control of the world's dominant military apparatus. You know, the will to power could not find a more felicitous expression than in control of the American body politic.
Yeah.
And that's your stakes in this game. And as you say, you know, there's this tremendous pall over Congress when Roger Clemens walks in, and are we going to tarnish the game of baseball or
yeah,
whatever?
Right. Uh-huh.
And yet we're living this revolting, absolutely revolting national lie. And when Clint Curtis comes up with evidence, or we come up with evidence, you know, whatever, we're basically told to sit down, shut up, go out, you know, go home, stop making waves. And, you know, I only wish we were better. I wish we were better at what we do. I'm not sure how you get there. I sometimes, you know, think that if we were better, we'd be writing our death warrants. I mean, that, you know, if we really threatened the system, we'd be, you know, fairly vulnerable on a personal level to being shut up one way or another. So we must not be doing very well, because nobody seems to even care enough to hang a chicken over our garage door. You know what I'm saying? I mean, we're doing whatever we do, and who's ever, you know, watching what we do is basically saying, well, you know, that's a mosquito buzzing at the screen. We don't have to worry about that. How do you get better? I don't know. You know, and on a personal level, I look at, you know, there are times when you stand there and you say, well, you know, with old Mayor Koch, you know, from New York City, how am I doing? And you look at it and you say, well, am I doing enough? Am I doing enough? And you look at Nathan Hale, and, you know, who said, I regret that I have but one life to give for my country. And you look at somebody who sacrificed his life and, you know, went to the gallows. And you say, well, geez, you know, I seem to be worried about, oh, I don't know, you know, losing a couple hours sleep, or, you know, missing my daughter's soccer match or whatever. You know, I don't stack up very well against good old Nathan. And then you look at, you know, the 300 million or so Americans who are doing absolutely nothing, not contributing in terms of funds, which could also obviously help in publicity and doing the things we need, not lifting a finger. Very often saying, wow, you're doing a great thing, that's great, you know, and then just going back to their whatever their business is. And you say, well, okay, you know, at least I'm doing something, I'm active in this area. And then you look at Nelson Mandela and you say, well, I haven't gone to jail for 28 years or whatever it is. You look at Steve Biko,
Jonathan,
you know, I'm not doing enough.
Don't beat yourself up that way. I really appreciate what you do. I consider you a patriot. I thank you for your passion on this issue. And I hope you won't give up. Do compartmentalize it so it doesn't corrode everything. But it's a very important set of issues, and we must keep fighting for the truth. Jonathan D. Simon is the executive director of the Election Defense Alliance, on the web, electiondefensealliance.org. And normally we play Roy Rogers and Trigger on the way out, but today a special tune for the Republican Tea Party nominee for the U.S. Senate from the little state of Delaware. This is Roy Zimmerman. We'll dedicate this to the abstinence queen, Christine O'Donnell. This one's called Abstain With Me.
To do tonight, and I believe in abstinence only, but I don't wanna leave you lonely, so abstain with me, baby. All night long, come over and refrain with me, baby. All night. Gonna wanna jump your bones. I'm gonna have to dump that Jones. So come on now, get stoned in lover's lane with me. Abstain with me. Oh, baby. When you're not there, I'm blue. Yeah, baby, I think you know where I'm blue. And I remember sex education as approved by the administration. So abstain with me, baby. Feel the strain with me, baby. All night long, we're gonna have the urge to merge, an urge we're gonna have to purge on the verge. So come on now, be an excruciating pain with me. Abstain. Vain with me, abstain.